Today, yet more proof, the RBA's answer is always higher home prices. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. Now, as I've said before, late Friday afternoons is when the officials who really don't want stuff to be noticed put stuff out. And last Friday, there were no less than three Freedom of Information responses released by the RBA, typically putting the trash out. One was technical and related to the cause of the recent ASX outage. But the other two were more profound and combined underscores just how myopic our central bank is and how high-handed their actions have been and continue to be. And it seems that they are wedded to ever higher home prices to solve our economic woes, despite the obvious consequences. First, there was a release relating to, quote, the impact of monetary policy on savers, depositors, and self-funded retirees. Over the past 5 years, they said, household financial income, which includes from interest, dividends, and superannuation, has grown well below longer run averages, mainly reflecting lower interest rates. High income and older households are likely to have been most affected because they receive a greater share of their income from these sources. Monetary policy stimulus has two-sided effects on the income and wealth of depositors and self-funded retirees, i.e. households that are ineligible for the age pension, and that's around 40% of households above retirement age. On the downside, they said, interest income is a more important source of income for older households relative to younger households. Households 55 years plus are recipients of two-thirds of interest income, and that share has been quite stable for 15 years, according to the HILDA 2018 data. And 5% of households with a head aged 65 years plus earns more than 20% of their income directly from interest, according to HILDA. Now, of course, superannuation is excluded from this estimate. If we include an estimate imputed interest earned via super, then the share of households will go up to around 20%. And let me just make the point here, this is data from 2018. It's very old data, and since then interest rates have dropped significantly further. So it's likely that the RBA is understating the true impact. And they said, for those aged 65 years plus, interest income on average is 7% of gross regular income. And for people aged 75 to 79 and over, interest income is 10% of gross regular income. Again, according to that HILDA data from 2017-18, which is so old as to be laughable. We are now, of course, in 2021, and my surveys highlight that more recently households become ever more stressed because of falls in income. And they said households reliant on interest income are now required to draw down on more of their savings than in the past to maintain the same cash flows. Well, of course, actually what is happening in practice, according to my surveys, is that some are actually just hunkering down and spending less, and others are eating their own savings. Of course, that can't go on forever, but nevertheless, there's very little alternative choice unless they decide to put savings into higher risk alternatives. Then they said, on the upside, net savers, including self-funded retirees, receive significant indirect benefits through stronger economic conditions and higher asset prices. Housing accounts for half of the wealth of households 65 years plus. Hang on a moment. So what they're saying is, never mind cash flow, because the capital value of your property is going to rise, and therefore everything is fine. Monetary stimulus, they say, supports employment. For young savers, unemployment has been a far greater effect on income than low rates. First home buyer commitments have increased, which is positive for younger households. And low rates, they say, are also supporting government borrowing and subsequently the economic recovery. And they said also interest income could partly be offset by income support payments, although possibly different households and most self-funded retirees are ineligible. So why are they making that point? The point is that older households have been ineligible for most of the support mechanisms, so that's just rubbish. And they said deeming rates were lowered to a range of 0.25 to 2.25%, and deeming is an important consideration in the age pension income test. Retiree advocacy groups argue that current deeming rates are still too high, given the current level of the cash rate, and that could push retirees to consider riskier investments like equities. Yep, equities, or even Bitcoin, as I've seen in some recent surveys. So the RBA is basically arguing itself into a corner here, saying, of course, high home prices are fine and other people are receiving government support. But the point is, those with this problem, with lack of income from savings and deposits, are being hit. And then they went on to say, the policy of the Reserve Bank will support the economy and asset prices, and the Reserve Bank's term funding facility, bond purchases, and lower interest rates across the yield curve will assist the recovery by lowering financing costs for borrowers and supporting the supply of credit, contributing to a lower exchange rate, supporting asset prices and balance sheets, and making sure that households and businesses spending can continue, especially for credit-constrained households. So overall, it should support consumption and investment. And they said housing prices are likely to rise alongside other asset prices. And recent research from the RBA, of course, showed that house prices are likely to rise on a permanent basis of 100 basis points. House prices could rise 30%, or if it was temporary, 10% after 3 years, according to recent research published by a Mr. Tulip. Monetary policy appears to have larger effects on local areas in which housing supply constraints are binding, mortgage debt is higher, and there are more housing investors, they said. And currently, much of the credit growth is coming from owner-occupiers, and first-time buyer activity has strongly risen in recent months as a positive indication of access to housing for young households, according to the loan commitments data. And then went on to say, well, there are some risks that may increase due to these low interest rates and implicitly because of high home prices. High unemployment is the biggest risk to the economy. Balance sheets and medium-term financial and macro stability and lower interest rates can help reduce that risk, they said. Asset prices can induce borrowers to take on too much credit if accompanied by looser lending standards and or an optimistic, maybe an over-optimistic assessment of risk. And new LVR lending above 85% of housing may well rise, but then, of course, they said it's well below levels seen before 2015. And also the share of loans to first home buyers, where they have smaller deposits than repeat buyers, could also create risks. And if price rises induce large amounts of new property construction, this can create an overhang of excess supply, causing prices to fall further eventually. And more of the loan book will be borrowers who bought near the price peak, as new properties purchased tend to increase during booms. That means that more of the loan book is likely to be in negative equity. And then they said, well, but of course, Australia's financial regulators will monitor and control risks, and the Council of Financial Regulators will act if needed. Phew, well, that's all right then. Since 2015, lending standards tightened substantially, they said, for both housing and commercial property, and APRA and ASIC have both taken steps to reinforce sound lending for residential mortgages in particular, except, of course, that they're walking back responsible lending, and we know that the banks are now powering up and lending more because that's the only game in town. And they mentioned the Reserve Bank of New Zealand, which is planning to reinstate high LVR lending restrictions in March 2021. And high loan-to-value lending has increased sharply in New Zealand, and house price growth has been strong, so they can see what happens when this runs away. And of course, there are increasing issues in New Zealand, as I discussed in a recent post. The restrictions, they say, were removed in May for what was meant to be 12 months, and the aim was to support credit supply and avoid impacting debt repayment holidays. Now, Bloomberg reported what the Reserve Bank had said like this. Australia's central bank is worried an extended period of very low interest rates could spur borrowers to take on more debt than they can handle, particularly if lending standards slip and risk appetite increases. Documents released on Friday under a Freedom of Information request shows the Reserve Bank of Australia saw risks in its decisions to cut the key interest rate to 0.1%, introduce a lending facility for banks and buy government bonds. And it said the Council of Financial Regulators would act to control risks if needed. The RBA cited research that a permanent 100 basis point reduction in the cash rate increased real house prices by 30% after about 3 years. Australia's housing market proved relatively resilient to the economy tipping into its first recession in almost 30 years, with prices easing before bouncing back at year's end. The ability to work remotely boosted property markets outside the mixed cities. Home prices in regional areas jumped more than three times capital city prices. The FOI document looks at the broader impact of easy policy on savers, depositors and self-funded retirees. The RBA said that over the past 5 years, income from interest, dividends and superannuation had fallen well below longer run averages, mainly due to low rates. Yet it said this is offset somewhat from higher asset prices. Among the other risks of low rates, the RBA cited loan-to-value ratios above 85% for housing increased, though they're still well below those in 2015. This, it said, partially reflected an increased share of loans for first-time buyers who typically have smaller deposits than repeat buyers, and that price rises could induce large amounts of new property construction, which could create an overhang of excess supply, causing prices to fall further. And then they referred to a separate FOI document on inequality caused by monetary policy settings. The RBA looked at a recent International Monetary Fund paper that recommended central banks explicitly target consumption inequality alongside the inflation and unemployment objectives. Whether and how the central bank should account for inequality in its decision making remains an open question, the RBA said in response. While the IMF's paper showed it could be welfare improving in theory, the generalizability of this result is unclear. Nevertheless, the RBA acknowledged that there has been growing interest in the topic among central banks, with the Federal Reserve's recent framework change potentially one way central banks can implicitly target inequality without the perception they're overstepping their existing mandates, the RBA said. So now let's go look at that other Freedom of Information release, because this is actually very concerning. They said, a recent IMF staff working paper suggests that central banks should explicitly target consumption inequality alongside their inflation and unemployment objectives. In effect, this framework prescribes looser monetary policy to reduce consumption inequality by boosting labour incomes for poorer individuals. However, the conclusions are model specific, they said, and more work is needed to show that the result can be generalised. Now, they added to this theoretical work by looking at how central banks have begun to think about this issue in practice, including a discussion of the Fed's recent framework change and empirical studies. And they said, in recent IMF working paper, the authors show that it is optimal for the central bank to explicitly target inequality when setting policy using a backward-looking Taylor rule. In this setup, there are two types of agents. One, the Keynesian, lives hand-to-mouth on their labour income and has no access to financial markets, while the second, the Ricardian, also owns all the equity Ricardian agents, they say, form a slight majority, around 6% of the population. The two groups, wealth inequality, translates into income inequality as monopolistic firms' profits are distributed as dividends. The government's tax policies determine to what extent these dividends are redistributed between the two agent types. And the authors found, in response to a positive shock, inequality increases along two dimensions. Firstly, wealthy individuals' share of labour income increases through an increase in demand for skilled labour. And secondly, firms' profits increase, which flows to these same agents as dividends. Including consumption inequality in the central bank's optimization problem result in a lower policy rate than the central bank otherwise would have set in response to the shock. Supporting employment and wages, this disproportionately benefits the poor as they derive their incomes solely from labour. This improves social welfare, they said, as measured by agents' lifetime consumption. It also results in a small positive inflation gap in the short term, as opposed to a larger negative gap when consumption inequality is ignored. This inflation gap tends to zero after 10 quarters. But, they said, there are some limitations in this paper. The paper's key limitation, which is acknowledged by the authors, is that it only models the impact of a positive productivity shock. Given this is a deflationary shock that also increases the unemployment gap and consumption inequality, the central bank does not face a trade-off between stabilizing inflation and its other objectives. All three components of its policy rules suggest it should decrease the policy rate. Further work could look at whether the above result holds for demand-side shocks, for example. Another important limitation is that the modelling of wealth inequality is limited to uneven profit distribution. Given the importance of asset prices monetary policy transmission, it will be useful to look at inequality dynamics in a model extended to capture wealth effects. In other words, home prices growth, for example. Finally, the paper assumes Ricardians and Keynesians face the same labour supply decision. This is a deliberate choice to analyse the effects of monetary policy on inequality without introducing indirect distortions due to income inequality. Further extensions could introduce type-dependent labour supply. There are, of course, they say, also practical impediments to targeting inequality through monetary policy. Central banks do not undertake a rigid optimization exercise each time they set the policy rate, nor do they follow a simple mechanistic Taylor rule. Instead, the monetary policy decision is dynamic and takes into consideration a wide range of factors, making it, they say, difficult to distill it down to a policy rule. The Fed's recent change to its framework is one example of how a central bank may choose to implicitly target inequality in practice. Its new approach places greater weight on unemployment and less on inflation, which makes decisions in recognition of the benefits from employment and wage growth accruing to those at the bottom of the income distribution relative to the cost of low inflation. There may be positive political economy effects from acknowledging and expressing concern about monetary policy's impact on equality above and beyond its actual policy implications, inflation or financial stability, they said. However, there could also be a backlash if the central bank is perceived as straying outside its mandate. While other central banks have not gone as far as the Fed, they have been commenting on the unequal impact of the COVID recession across social groups. An empirical interest in monetary policy and inequality has also increased since the global financial crisis, and recent analysis found that contradictory shocks increase income inequality as they hit the wages of the poorest individuals hardest, and a similar pattern is observed for consumption inequality. So when it comes to unconventional policy, quantitative easing in particular can be viewed as exacerbating inequality by disproportionately benefiting asset holders who are typically financially better off. However, they say recent ECB research has challenged this notion. It found that after 1 year, QE reduced income inequality by decreasing unemployment and increasing wages, particularly at lower income quantiles. It also marginally decreased wealth inequality by boosting house prices. There you go. Once again, house prices are the saviour. This is because households in lower quintiles of the wealth distribution tend to have high stocks of debt. And so an increase in housing prices reduces their level of indebtedness. Well, wait a minute, think about that. Bigger debts, sure, but bigger house prices means it's no problem. Well, I don't think I buy that argument. Lastly, the results cited in this chatter may have a temporal dimension, they said. It is possible that monetary policy worsens inequality in the short run, but decreases it over the medium run once it is fully transmitted to the real economy and employment and wages benefits are realised. This issue was touched upon in some recent research, where it was noted that in the decade following the global financial crisis, both income and wealth inequality declined as employment growth for minorities and those with high school education outpaced that for their more advantaged peers, particularly between 2016 and 19 in the US, when the unemployment rate reached very low levels. They attributed that partly to the continued Fed stimulus. So they concluded whether and how the central bank should account for inequality in its decision making remains an open question. While the IMF's recent paper shows it could be welfare improving in theory, the generalizability of this result is unclear. Nevertheless, there has been growing interest in the topic amongst central banks, and the Fed's recent framework change appears to be one way central banks can implicitly target inequality without the perception that they are overstepping their existing mandates. Now, let's just think about what they've argued. They've said that asset price is good. In fact, more asset price is better. And of course, very low rates will continue to make that more significant. And they also say that sure, there will be inequalities, and go back to that first FOI where they talked about savers being crucified by very low rates. But then they argue that overall, the net benefit to the broader economy is neutral to positive. But the cornerstone of their arguments for both of these topics is simply this. Let's cut rates. Let's get people to borrow more. Let's make house prices rise. And if we do that, we're going to be economically advantaged. To which I reply, that's absolute rubbish. Sure, some will, and you'll pull more people into the housing sector to drive prices higher, despite ever higher debt. But the inequality that is being created by those who rely on savings and those who feel unwilling or unable to invest any savings in financial markets because of the risks continue to be disadvantaged. And it seems to me that that silent minority, considerable though it is, about 40% of households, means that the Reserve Bank continues to peddle its home price mantra, its low rate mantra, and it's of course all to do with financial stability and supporting the banking system, not supporting the maximum interests of those in the economy. So I have to say that this really bells the cat with regard to the Reserve Bank's thinking. Home prices is the weapon they're using. Expect higher prices because it's engineered into what the bank is doing, despite the consequences. And that, in my view, is first a disgrace. Second, it is something that should be being discussed much more than currently, but most of the media, of course, is just celebrating high home prices once again, despite high debt. And we're not having the more mature, broader conversations that we should be having of what the levers of growth long-term should be and what the policy settings need to be. So this is a very important set of disclosures. No wonder it was thrown out late on a Friday evening, and hopefully the Reserve Bank thought nobody was watching. But we were. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.